Good morning. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. The House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will come to order. The Committee of Legislative Assistant will call the roll.
Kamansky?
Present.
Johnson?
Here.
Anderson?
Here.
Campion?
Here.
Cornish? Grunhagen?
Here.
Hillstrom?
Here.
Treisel?
Here.
Lane? Lesh? Liebman? Nazarov?
Here.
Schumacher?
Here.
Vogel?
Here.
Wardlow?
Here.
Thank you.
There being a quorum present, we will proceed without, hear testimony this morning. First of all, we will approve the minutes of the previous meeting. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? So Representative Grunhagen moves the minutes of the previous meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion carried. We will now hear a presentation by our House Fiscal Analyst, Emily Adrians, with the assistance of our House researcher, Rebecca Purius. Would you, when you're ready, ladies, would you introduce yourself? Okay. I understand. But when you're ready, just feel free to proceed. Introduce yourself for the tape, and we'll listen to your testimony.
You can all see it, right?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Morning, Julie.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Okay, my name is Emily Adrians. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee, and Becky Purius is with House Research. She's been so kind to help me out with this. And first, we just want to kind of, before we get into the general overview, we wanted to kind of make sure everybody has all the documents that we passed out. The presentation, so you should have the presentation packet, and then you should also have a sheet that looks kind of like this. It looks like a fund balance. And then also a document that has, it's a glossary of some of the fiscal terms and the acronyms that we'll go over from time to time in the committee that looks like this. So these are kind of the things that we'll be referencing throughout the presentation. Okay. It's really early in the morning. Thanks for your patience. Okay, so what Becky and I intend to do is kind of give you a good general overview of the committee and the jurisdiction that the committee has over different accounts. And so if you look at, the second slide, these are the committee accounts that we have. We have the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, the District, or sometimes they're referred to as the trial courts, Tax Court, the Public Defense Board, the Guardian Ad Litem Board, the Judicial Standards Board, Sentencing Guidelines Commission, Uniform Laws Commission, and the Legal Professions Board. The Guardian Ad Litem Board, as a lot of you know, that is new as of fiscal year 2011. So this is the first fiscal year that that's been a state-operated entity. And then I just also want to point out that the Legal Professions Board, that's the only account that the committee has that isn't funded with general fund dollars. That's a special, it's fee revenue. The attorneys that practice in the state of Minnesota are charged a registration fee, and so part of that registration fee goes to funding some of the boards, including the Legal Professions Board. Now, this is a pie chart of all of the general fund spending for the fiscal 2010 and 2011 biennium. And this isn't to make us feel like we're small. We're a very important committee, but just to kind of give you a sense of where some of the spending occurs from the general fund budget. The entire budget is just a little bit over $30 billion. And, you know, everybody kind of knows the biggest ones. K-12 education's on there. That's almost 40%. Health and Human Services, that's about 30%. And then judiciary is about 2% of that entire pie. just to kind of give a relative sense of where we are. But again, no less important. The amount that is, it's each year we have, well, in fiscal 10, the total is about $350 million. In fiscal 11, it's about $384 million. So the total for the biennium is about $735 million out of that big pie of general fund spending. Now, Becky is going to take over.
Mr. Chair and members, as Ms. Adrian's explained, she's going to be giving the history of funding in our various institutions, but we thought it might also help the committee members if they had some general background information, as well as highlighting some issues that frequently will come before this committee. So we'll start with the judicial branch. Can you move it? Oh. And maybe should have started with this one. The judicial branch is divided into 10 different judicial districts.
Excuse me, Ms. Pierce. Would members please turn off their cell phones? Yeah, as well as those in the crowd. Thank you. Please continue, Ms. Pierce.
Mr. Chair, the Minnesota judicial branch is divided into 10 judicial districts, which hopefully you can see the boundaries on this page. The state has 87 counties, and they are organized into these districts. Ramsey and Hennepin County are each a district in their own. They are the second and fourth judicial districts. And then the remaining eight districts are made up of 4 to 17 counties. Yeah, thanks. And this page lists the number of judgeships that are authorized throughout the state. So as you can see, the district or the trial courts statewide have 289 judgeships authorized. The Court of Appeals is 19, and the Supreme Court is 7. And then there are some numbers on judicial salaries. There we go. If you flip to this chart in your packet, this is demonstrating the three levels of courts that we have in our system and the cases that each of the courts hear, as well as the appeals route that is taken. There are three levels within the court system. There's the district court, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court. You'll also note there is a conciliation court. This is our smalls claim court. It hears, it's within the district court, and it hears civil disputes that involve less than $7,500 in controversy. And actually, this chart is from 2008. It's outdated already. Last year, the legislature enacted legislation that would allow certain forfeiture claims to be heard in conciliation court up to $15,000. So a person might choose conciliation court if they fall within that number due to the fact that it's a more informal process than the district court, and also the civil filing fees in conciliation court are $65 versus $310 in the district court. And then during the overviews to come, you may hear reference to the state takeover. The courts were previously county funded, and in the 1990s, the state began to gradually take over funding for the courts, and this transition was completed in 2005.
And let me, I just want to make a note. I know this is really hard to see on your copies that you have. It's really tiny print. And so we can send the presentation out if you'd like, so that people have kind of a bigger copy of all this.
Thank you. That would be appreciated.
Oh, yeah. And Mr. Chair, I was also going to mention this chart, and there's other details on the Minnesota judiciary in this publication. It's a little outdated. I didn't hand it out today because it would be another 30 to 40 pages for you to look at. But if you're interested, I can get it to you, and it's also on the web. So as I mentioned before, there was a $310 filing fee in district court for civil claims. Another fee that you may hear about in the civil arena is the criminal and petty misdemeanor surcharge. This is a $75 surcharge imposed on all persons convicted of a crime or a petty misdemeanor, so that would include your traffic tickets. And there's a $12 surcharge on parking violations. And I won't go through the allocation and the history, but you can see those. Those are for your reference. Also, I just wanted to note that the criminal surcharge cannot be waived by the court, but it can be ordered paid in installments. And the civil filing fee, the $310 or the $65, may be waived if the person meets certain financial requirements, and that you will hear referred to as IFP, which is Informa Pauperis.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add on to just one note about the fees. The court's taken quite a bit of revenue, but I'm not sure of the proportion, but part of the revenue that comes into the courts goes directly to the general fund, and then part of it is directed to other things. We have a sheet from Hennepin County where some of the recipients of their revenue from filing fees and some of these surcharges, it might go to different cities or municipalities within the county, the State Patrol, the University of Minnesota, the Metropolitan Airports Commission. So just so there's a sense of where that revenue comes, you know, how it comes in and flows back out, but it doesn't, none of it is dedicated directly to the funds, or to the, I'm sorry, to the courts.
If I may just ask a question, Ms. Adrians. Do we have a relative number, how much those fees coming into the general fund versus how much we're appropriating to the courts from the general fund? Do we know what that balance is?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I want to say that, well, for Hennepin County, I'm afraid I don't know on a statewide level.
All right.
I can get back to you on that. Okay. For Hennepin County, the county collects approximately, let's say, $54 million. This was in fiscal 2009. They collected $54 million, and then their operating budget for the courts was $50 million. So the county is bringing in 107% of its operating budget, but it's not. That's not what funds the operating budget, if that makes sense.
Understood. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to make it real clear that one of the reasons why we don't have the fees that the courts collect go to fund the courts is because if people perceive that the courts are generating their own revenue, then they don't believe that they're an impartial court.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Hillstrom.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, what I wanted to do is look at kind of a historical, give you kind of a sense of some of the funding and how it's gone. I do want to remind you that with the court takeovers that Becky was referencing before, It makes some of these charts look like there's this huge increase of funding for the courts, and part of that is because of the court takeover, the courts being administered by the state versus by the local entities. So there was money that would go to the counties, to the local entities, to do some of this administration, and then that amount of money that was given to the counties was reduced, and then state funding was increased. So it's not that there was just this huge influx of money for the courts. It's partly to do with that. So the first one that we'll look at is the Supreme Court funding. And so, again, starting back in the 90s, it was closer to around $20 million. And all the numbers, too, let me remind you that I'll show you, they're always in thousands. So so don't think that it was $20,000 that the courts were getting. It was $20 million. And then they kind of had, you know, it would go up a little bit and then down, and so you'll see that the increase is a little bit turbulent. And then it peaked in fiscal year 2009, and just to give you a sense of that, when that court takeover, I believe it was finished in 2005. So from 2005, that's when you can kind of look at the funding increase. And then in fiscal 10, it went down a little bit, and then kind of went back up in 2011, but not to the highest point. And then the second chart, I thought this just might be interesting for the number of FTEs, that's full-time employees. So these are the number of employees that the Supreme Court had starting going back again to fiscal year 1997. And again, with taking over the administration of the courts, that's why you kind of have this huge increase up through 2004 and 5, and then you see a little bit of a dip in 2006, and then kind of a steadier increase, but I kind of want you to focus on from 2009 to 10 to 11. That's that decrease that you've been hearing about in order to kind of constrain the budget a little bit, where they've been reducing full-time employees. So the next one we'll look at is the Court of Appeals. And the funding, again, you have this increase from the late 1990s. And then, again, starting looking at fiscal 2005, there is a pretty good increase up through 2009, and then it goes down and through 2011. The full-time employees for the Court of Appeals, that has remained fairly consistent relative to some of the other areas. So they've always been able to have around 80 full-time employees, you know, with a bit of a surge in fiscal 2009 and then a reduction that was a little bit steeper than they had ever experienced going down to 2011.
If I may ask a question, Ms. Adrian. Sure. From 2000, it looks like our Court of Appeals FTEs was fairly level from 97 to 2007, and then it began increasing rapidly in 08 and 09. Mm-hmm. Do we have any rationale why the numbers increased substantially in those years?
You know, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure about that. There might be somebody in the audience who could answer that question.
Would you like to come forward and introduce yourself, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. Mr. Chair, in response to your question, we added 3 Court of Appeals judges, and that's why you'll see the spike. And with the Court of Appeals judge came an administrative assistant and law clerks.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So then going to the trial court's funding, again, with the takeover of with the state doing the administration of the courts, that explains some of that huge increase from 1997 to 2000. And the way that they did the takeover, why some of this is kind of gradual instead of a one-year thing, was that they did it sort of district by district. It started out as a pilot program with a few counties to kind of see how it would go, and then they decided to continue with all the counties until they were finished. And then the court saw a pretty good increase after 2005, and then it got a little bit rocky again where it would be the increase. And some of that has to do with one-time federal funds, too, that, you know, we've seen in a lot of different areas. But, this is just general fund money, so forget about
Excuse
the federal
me, Ms. Adrian,
funds.
Excuse me, Adrian, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just give me a brief explanation on what the rationale was for the state taking over the funding of the courts?
The administration. Mr. Chair, members, I might defer to Ms. Marshall again.
All right. Ms. Marshall, would you come forward again? And once more, just for the tape, introduce yourself.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall with the State Court Administrator's Office. Mr. Chair, in response to the question, the state takeover of the trial court costs actually started back in the early 80s. They started studying it, and they decided that the judicial branch was a state-level third equal co-branch of government, and that in order to have equal justice throughout the state, that the state should be bearing the costs for the trial courts. It started out with a pilot project that started in 1990, and that pilot project in the 8th Judicial District went on for 10 years. And finally, after study by the governor's office, by the counties, by the Supreme Court, they decided to go forward and bring over the costs for all the trial courts. And they did that 2 districts at a time until they were completed with the project.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Representative Johnson, any further?
No, thank you, sir.
All right. Please continue, Ms. Adrian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I appreciate your patience. Being new, I will be up to speed, I'm sure, in a matter of days. I'll know all of this information.
Okay.
Oh, we were on the trial courts. So then going to the trial court FTEs, the full-time employees. Again, less consistent than the appellate courts, increasing up through 2005, and then a pretty sharp dip, and then kind of that influx a little bit and decreasing, just like you've seen in some of the other courts since fiscal year 2009. Now, this is sort of a line-by-line. A line-by-line account of the funding that will happen within the jurisdiction of the committee. And so I think that, you know, you can kind of look over it. The biggest expenditure for the committee of all the appropriations that the committee will do is in the trial court area. And that amounts to, in the biennium, almost half a billion. So close to $500 million. In the trial courts, that makes up about two-thirds of the committee funding that we have. The next biggest chunk is the Public Defense Board at $64 and $65 million in each of those fiscal years. That monster, that's closer to like almost 20% of the committee's funding. You'll see the Guardian Ad Litem Board there. It's zero in fiscal 2010 because, again, it wasn't state-operated. And then it will go up to about $12.3 million for each year after that will be their source of funding. And then...
Pardon me.
Sure.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to clarify about the Guardian Ad Litem Board funding because I carried that bill. That was funding that was allocated within the budget. And so it's just a new line. It's not new funding.
Exactly right, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, it's not an increase. It was taken from... And actually, that gives me a nice segue. The trial courts, the number on your sheets is wrong. I had in the slides you can see up here, it's correct. But I had $248 million, and actually there was a transfer out in fiscal 2011 of about $3 million, and that was in part to help fund the Guardian Ad Litem Board. So yes, Representative, you're correct about that. And then let's see, the Supreme Court. About a little more than $40 million each year, and then some of the other boards. It's a little bit of a smaller amount. The Judicial Standard Boards, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, Uniform Laws Commission is the smallest chunk. Now again, the on here this is just general fund spending, so we don't have you won't see the Legal Professions Board on this line on these lines. This is just general fund spending. And then I also want to point out that we heard in the presentation the other day a little bit about the civil legal services. And they do get state funding, and they are housed within the Supreme Court appropriation. So the Supreme Court does not get all of this $40 million. Civil legal services gets almost $12 million each year, and that'll be a rider underneath the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court funding is actually a little bit less than $30 million each year. And just a reminder for what civil legal services is, they are appointed by the Supreme Court, and there's a legal services advisory committee, and what they do is they distribute funds to civil legal services programs in order to provide legal assistance to low-income persons meeting statutory income eligibility guidelines. So it's sort of similar to public defenders, but it's not a constitutional mandate like the public defenders are.
Excuse me, Ms. Adrians.
Yes.
Ms. Curious, in the glossary of terms, is that defined in there as well?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Civil legal services?
Civil legal services, yes.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it is. It's towards the back. It's actually page 45, which is a tad deceiving. It's about three pages in from the back.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair and members, I have I highlighted the courts just because those were kind of the areas that we were talking about. And tax court we didn't really cover very in depth, but it is it's just where you know, for example, if someone wanted to bring up their property tax, if they didn't agree with their property tax and wanted to take it to court, and exactly. It's specialized within the executive branch. So and it's a much smaller amount of funding, about $1.5 million for the biennium, and then This is kind of a good time. I just want to quick have you look at the sheet that looks kind of like a fund balance that I've included. We're trying to focus just on the historical information right now, so I don't want you to get too into the future bienniums, but this, as we start getting farther along in session, we'll start looking at some of these numbers. And what you have, this is from Minnesota Management and Budget. It's their fund balance, and it's based on the November 2010 forecast. And we'll get an update on numbers for the February forecast, which often happens more like the first week of March. And so what this shows is that there are other sources of funding for all of the committee accounts that we have. So if you look at the Supreme Court, there's general fund monies that goes there, but there's also money from a special revenue fund. And when there are fees that are collected, like that attorney registration fee that I talked about, which actually a lot of you probably pay because you're attorneys in the state of Minnesota. But some of that money goes into these special revenue funds. And so that's where that comes from. Some of the federal monies that go to the different areas. And then a small portion through a gift fund. And so this will show you kind of like the future bienniums. But again, we're just trying to focus right now on the current funding sources and historical. But this, I just kind of wanted to get you used to looking at some of this information, and later we'll talk about.
Excuse me, Ms. Adrians, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Adrians, as I listen to this and I look at these charts that you've given us, which are really informative, I wonder, though, if it would be helpful to the committee. It would certainly be helpful to me to look at this data in a little bit different way and maybe some future meeting. So when I look at, for example, the trial courts, the FTEs and the increase over time, which was on 13, I think it is, and I'm kind of wondering how that looks, first of all, to look at that as total funding, not just general fund money,
okay,
would be really helpful so that it would, I think, it'd be more meaningful to us to see what they've actually had to use for their budget. But I also think it would be useful to look at that either per capita for the state or perhaps even per case. Now, I know there could be a lot of different ways to look at it, but I just, you know, even though it's interesting to see that trend and those increases, I just am a little concerned that it's misleading to look at all of this funding in that way, because we're not seeing, you know, there's a big change in population from 1997 to 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we could find a way to try to look at that in a different way, I think it would be helpful.
All right. Ms. Adrians?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I'm happy to do that. And you are right that it's harder. It's not really the entire picture when we look at the general fund. A lot of times we just focus on that because that's what we get to affect. But yes, I can most certainly get some of that information for you.
Great. Any follow-up questions, Representative Liebling?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Please continue, Ms. Adrians.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, we're next going to move to public defenders. The public defenders are also divided amongst the 10 judicial districts. And as you may remember from last week, the public defenders are constitutionally and statutorily mandated to represent indigent defendants in certain criminal and juvenile matters. They do not represent individuals in civil matters or petty misdemeanors. A petty misdemeanor does not carry a jail sentence, so that would be your traffic ticket. So they do not represent people for petty misdemeanors. Last week, there were several references to mandated services versus non-mandated services, and I thought it might be helpful for the committee to see some of that. If you look at section 611.14, this lists some of the public defender's mandated services. So people who are financially unable to obtain counsel are entitled to a public defender, and they include a person charged with a felony, a gross misdemeanor, or a misdemeanor, a person appealing a conviction or who is pursuing a post-conviction appeal, a person who's entitled to be represented by counsel in a probation revocation hearing, and under number four, a minor 10 years of age or older who is entitled to be represented in a juvenile delinquency case or in a CHIPS case. And a CHIPS case is child protection. It's children in need of protection or services. If you flip to the next page, this provides an example of a non-mandated service. And I'm bringing this up because it was referenced last week, and but it wasn't explained, and I think the committee will probably hear about it again. So the non-mandated service here is the representation of parents in CHIPS cases. Before June of 2008, the public defenders did represent parents in some CHIPS cases, but as the budget crisis set in June of 2008, the Board of Public Defense resolved to discontinue such service. And in this case, in the matter of JB and RP, the district court had ended up appointing private counsel to parents in CHIPS cases, and the issue became whether this was an error, whether they should have appointed a public defender, and who was required to actually pay for this counsel. The Minnesota Supreme Court held that indigent parents, guardians and custodians in these CHIPS cases are entitled to a court-appointed counsel, but they are not entitled to a public defender because they are not one of those people who are listed under 611.14. And then the court also held that the cost would be charged upon the county, so it would not be a state cost. So I hope that's a...
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, explanation. I'll move on. Another issue that you may hear of is the public defender fee. In 2009, the legislature enacted Section 481.22, which provided that the Supreme Court, through the Lawyer Registration Office, could assess a public defender a fee on each licensed attorney in the state, and then that money would be appropriated to the Board of Public Defense. In November of 2009, the Minnesota Supreme Court issued an order that temporarily increased the lawyer registration fee. So the Board of Public Defense and Civil Legal Services came in and petitioned the Supreme Court and asked for these fees. The public defense asked for $75 per year per attorney, basically, and Civil Legal Services asked for an increase of $25. Those petitions were granted, but they were set to expire on July 1st, 2011. And so currently there is a petition before the court, the public defenders, and I believe the Civil Legal Services have petitioned the court to continue this increase indefinitely.
Hey, Mr. Chair and members, now this is the last area where I have some of the historical funding and for the public defenders. And again, the same kind of the same increase that you saw before, this one a little bit more smoothed out. So starting in 1997, the public defenders had about $40 million, and then it increased pretty steadily, pretty gradually up until fiscal 2009. Then again, you saw the decrease to 2010, and then a small bump up in 2011, but overall kind of a downward trend. And then for the number of full-time employees for public defenders, a little more consistent between 1997 and 2005 with a gradual increase, and then pretty good increase in 2006, just over 600 public defenders, going up to about 2008, and then a steep drop to 2009, and then again a steady decline through fiscal 2011. So right now they're just below 500 full-time employees for the public defenders. And then again, just to give some reference for the amount of funding that goes to the Public Defense Board that administers the public defenders, $64 million, $65 million in each of the two fiscal years of this biennium to amount to about $130 million for the biennium. Is there a question?
I guess it kind of strikes me, not being a public defender or an attorney, with the $65 million, what are the expenses in the public defender's fund other than the attorney's fees?
Well, my understanding, Mr. Chair and members, for the expenditures is that it's, I want to say it's about 85% personnel goes toward the public defenders of their costs. And then the rest of it, let me see if it's in. The budget pages, I believe you also have in front of you, and these have some good information on some of the specifics of funding. And so they do have, so.
Excuse me, Ms. Adrians, the budget pages are in your folders for the members of the committee. So.
And they look like this. Each of the agencies puts these together. They're a nice reference tool to have. And so they also have administrative services and then an appellate office. And I can get a little more, I'll find out and get a little bit more detail for you later.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Eden.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, next we'll discuss the guardian ad litems.
All right. Just a second, Ms. Pierce. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, just for the committee's knowledge here, you'll hear the term 85 to 95% in a lot of our state agencies when they ask where the costs go, the personnel costs. That's not uncommon at all, so you shouldn't be worried about it. A lot of the state agencies, when they come up in front of us, we ask where their money goes, they'll say 85% to personnel, and it just makes common sense. People-oriented agencies that do most of the work, and so sometimes when people in a crowd hear that, they think, oh my gosh, I got to do layoffs or this or that, you know, but it's just perfectly normal to have that kind of a rate or a percentage of your funding going to personnel.
Thank you. Ms. Perius.
Mr. Chair, we're on the guardian ad litems. As has been mentioned, there was a transition just recently. The guardian ad litem program was previously housed within the Supreme Court Administration Office, and legislation was just passed last year, creating a new board. So the new state guardian ad litem board was created in October of 2010, and I'm not going to have much information for you. I assume you will hear more in the overview since it is so new. But in statute, the board is mandated to create and administer a statewide independent GAL program to advocate for the best interests of children, minor parents, and incompetent adults in juvenile and family court cases. And just to provide you an example of their duties, I copied the guardian's responsibilities in CHIPS cases out of Section 260C-163. And I'll just highlight, they conduct independent investigations to determine facts relevant to the child and the family situation. They meet with the child, interview parents, and then advocate for the child's best interests. Next is the
Excuse
board.
Excuse me, Ms. Perius. Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm going to talk about this board just briefly. I carried this board last session at the request of the courts. And the reason is because the guardian ad litems make recommendations to the courts, and they're appointed by the judge. And the judges felt, the Judicial Standards Board felt that they needed to have that separation in order to be unbiased. If the judge appoints the guardian and the guardian makes a recommendation and then the judge follows that recommendation, if the judge was the one that picked them and appointed them and they report to them, it doesn't have an appearance of impartiality. So they asked for an outside board so that someone else is coordinating them, organizing them, so when they make recommendations to the court can follow them or not follow them, and it's not their employees. That's all.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Is there any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Ms. Hillstrom can address this too. I was just wondering what kind of a cost, was there a cost savings or a cost increase to moving it from out from underneath the Supreme Court and creating its own board? Do you know?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, it's too early to tell. The court just said this is the amount of money we currently allocate for the service. We're just going to send that exact amount of money over to this other board and have them do it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and members, if I could add, in addition to the general fund money, if a court appoints a guardian ad litem and the parents are able to pay a fee for it, they do. So the guardian ad litem board, I think they estimate that they'll get approximately $2.7 million in fees to help with their funding.
Thank you, Ms. Adrian. Ms. Perius?
Mr. Chair and members, next is the Board of Judicial Standards. This board is an independent state agency that receives and acts upon complaints about Minnesota judges for judicial misconduct or wrongdoing, and they also handle disability matters. It was created in statute. And it's important to note that the board is not taking action on judicial error where someone believes that their case was decided wrongly. If you look towards the middle, this is from the board's page. They list some examples of judicial misconduct that they would handle, and it's improper courtroom demeanor, conflict of interest, chemical abuse, not adhering to the code of judicial conduct.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been following a little bit that Hennepin County case with the judge before the judicial standards. Interesting one. What does that cost, or what kind of bearing does that have? Is that a typical case that the judicial standards board would hear that results in money being used for that particular
Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson, I'm not sure how much I can comment on that. I have read that this is an abnormal year, I believe, for the board. I think I don't know about this case in particular, but I think they've had maybe around five cases where I think normally they have one to two, and they can correct me if I'm wrong at a later date, but that's the information I have. I think that would be a good question for the board.
Representative Johnson.
Well, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue with your testimony.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, again, with the funding for the Guardian Ad Litem Board, the funding really begins in fiscal year 2011 at about $12.3 million, and then the Judicial Standards Board takes about almost $500,000 each fiscal year.
Mr. Chair, members, next is the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. This is a commission created in statute, and one of its main initiatives was to create the sentencing guidelines, the grid, for the district court. That's actually on the next page. I won't go into detail on this. I just wanted to give you a reference for what we're talking about. The guidelines usually go over this chart a little more in depth, but if you can see it, the boxes in the middle contain the presumptive sentence that a court must give in a felony case. And it's based on the offender's criminal history, which is across the top, 0 through 6, so their past criminal history. And then the vertical axis is the severity level of the crime. And so using those two factors, you would come up with the presumptive sentence. You can go back. But the other thing I want to point out for the committee is that each January, the commission submits a report to the legislature, and the report may contain proposed modifications to these guidelines. And those proposals, under statute, will go into effect unless the legislature by law provides otherwise. So I have an example. Thank you. An example of this just occurred last year. The top half of this page is from the guidelines report to the legislature, and they had proposed re-ranking riot in the first degree, and as you can see, that had a bad impact, which was a fiscal cost. So below that, the legislature in laws 2010 delayed those changes. So that is the statutory language that was used to delay those recommendations. Back in 2005, I believe the legislature rejected some of the proposals. So I just wanted the committee to know that when looking through that report, which just came out, I have it somewhere, that those will go into effect unless the legislature provides otherwise. Mr. Chair and members, next is the Uniform Laws Commission. This is a commission that drafts state legislation in the area of private law. Some examples include the Uniform Commercial Code and the Uniform Probate Code. Minnesota has 8 commissioners who are uncompensated. The appropriation is actually paying for the annual dues and travel expenses.
And Mr. Chair and members, I'll just highlight for those two areas the funding for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Again, approximately $500,000 to total $1.1 million for the biennium. And Uniform Laws Commission is closer to $50,000. As she said, that it covers mostly just travel and dues. Both of these areas are almost strictly general fund. I believe there's some gift fund, like $1,000 a year, that might help support those areas of the committee.
Okay, Mr. Chair, this is our last slide. This is the Legal Professions Board. They're created under the Supreme Court's inherent authority to regulate the practice of law. I'll just briefly go over them. The Board of Law Examiners administers the bar exam and licenses attorneys to practice law. The Board of Continuing Education administers the CLE program that all licensed attorneys must participate in. The Board of Legal Certification certifies attorneys as specialists in certain fields of law. The Professional Responsibility Board oversees and administers the state's attorney discipline system, and the Client Security Board considers claims filed by and compensates victims of attorney theft.
And Mr. Chair and members, the funding for this, once again, is there's no general fund money that goes to support this. This is where the Supreme Court assesses a registration fee for attorneys practicing in Minnesota. That registration fee is authorized in statute, and it's held in trust for the regulation of the bar. The total amounts that they use each year is in fiscal 2010 it was about $5.3 million, and then in 2011 closer to $6 million. And the boards have 39 full-time equivalent employees. So I think that's it. And if there are any other questions, we can answer.
Okay. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, I guess Representative Anderson.
Have the court system, the employees, ever had a freeze put on them? Their salary freeze, have they experienced a salary freeze in any of these years?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe you're talking generally about any employees of any of the courts. I believe the public defenders haven't had a pay increase since, like, 2006, I want to say, and then I'm unsure about the rest of the employees. They have not had a freeze. Okay. Oh, they have had a freeze, yes. I believe all of the employees are on a freeze, similar to state-level employees over the past 2 years or so.
Okay. Representative Anderson, any further questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to add one more thing to my previous comment, and that is I think we also need to look in constant dollars, taking out inflation. And to kind of continue with Representative Cornish's comment about the 85% personnel, even if salaries are frozen, you still have escalating costs, particularly in health care. And, and that's just because of health care inflation. And I think you're going to find that across a lot of areas of the budget where, where it's a lot of its personnel costs. Only part of that is salary. And as salaries have kind of remained steady but healthcare costs have grown, I don't know if perhaps the proportion that salary versus benefits has changed. But that's something that a lot of the agencies really don't have control over. So I think it's really important for us as we look at these trends, what looks like escalating funding, and then you might say, well, why are they complaining? What's the problem? It looks like they're getting more and more and more. I think we need a more accurate picture of what that really buys for the agencies and what their responsibilities are, how much they have to do with the FDEs that they have, because I know particularly for the public defenders, I don't know if the mix has changed between attorneys and ancillary staff, because it's not all attorney salaries, it's also investigators and secretaries, and you know, so I know some of what the trend has been, at least in my area, Olmsted County, is that the attorneys, because there's less and less ancillary personnel, the attorneys have to do more and more clerical work, things that really aren't a good use of their time. So, you know, you sometimes, when the funding goes down, you get effects that actually aren't very good efficiencies. They can be counterproductive. So that's all something that we need to keep in mind as we look at this.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Ms. Adrians or Ms. Purius, do you have a reply to that?
No, Mr. Chair and members. I will look into that. And we often do look at numbers where we have inflation in or we take inflation out. So I will get you those numbers.
All right. Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Adrians, just to follow up on that freeze, is it a soft freeze or a hard freeze? Soft freeze is generally salary only, not benefits. Hard freeze is salary and benefits.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I am not sure. I will have to get back to you on that. My assumption is it's a salary freeze, but let me see if Ms. Marshall.
Ms. Marshall will come forward and clarify that for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall with the State Court Administrator's Office. Representative, in response to your question, I think we don't have, I'm not really sure what you're asking. We have had a hard freeze in our wages for at least the past 2 years, and the only other cost we have is the cost of pension and health insurance, and that's mandated, so we have no choice on whether or not we pay for the increased costs.
Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chair, in negotiations on school board, we had a if we had a freeze on salary, that was called a soft freeze. If you froze salary and benefits, like the increase in health care, in other words, you capped your contribution as a district, that was called a hard freeze. But it sounds like there's a statute that mandates that we pay the additional increase in health care costs.
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can say that the health care costs are negotiated by the executive branch, and then we just pay whatever is negotiated.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other further questions from the committee? Seeing none, the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will be adjourned until Thursday, January 20th, 2011, 8:15 a.m., or subject to the call of the chair. We are adjourned.